you have ever had the chance to shoot a fire hose full of water, what was it like? Fun? Did it have any pressure to it? If you weren't ready for it, what would happen to you?
You go backwards, faster.
Exactly right. Yeah, especially a decent sized hose. I recently had that experience, not flying backwards, but too close to it for comfort, where I was on a fire hose, and the pressure was just more than I expected. And so you have to be ready. You have to brace for it when you crack that line open. You better be ready. And the flip side, then, when you shut it, you kind of rock back forward, and you better be ready on that end of it, too. So I feel a little bit like I'm about to pop open the fire hose on you and just kind of drench you with a deluge of information. And I'm not sure. I hope it's helpful. Are you... have you felt it all this week a little bit overwhelmed by, say, the philosophical, just, oh, this is all about it, and you feel like you haven't gotten a lot of practical? And do you hope to get practical things for your classroom? Okay, because that's what you're going to get today. And as I looked over this again, it's like, well, do I just rapid fire, or how do we do this? And I think that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go down across. You kind of have an extensive handout. But I'm not really going to apologize, because I do want it to be something where you do have some practical things that you can go back and refer to, because you're going to have a lot of things to figure out. What am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with that? And that's the idea with this class called Procedures. Do you have procedures in your life right now? Quickly, give me a few procedures you have in your life. Mealtime, exactly. We know. Mealtimes. Getting up time, possibly, or your routine in the morning when you get up, right? Those are all things. They're procedures. It's simply a process that you follow in your life. We all have some procedures in our lives, and they take self-discipline to follow. Procedures and is simply a method or process for getting things done. And especially we're thinking about in the classroom. You could say a procedure is simply what the teacher wants done. You're going to be the teacher. You get to decide what happens in your classroom. A smooth running classroom is the responsibility of the teacher and the result of the teacher's ability to teach procedures. Procedures and routines create structure, and we need structure in school so that students can learn. In the first few days of school, focus on procedures that are necessary for the smooth beginning of your classroom. A number of those are quotes taken out of this book, The First Days of School. Highly recommend it. It's not necessarily a book that you'll pick up and just read from cover to cover, but there is a lot of practical help in here just on ways to handle things in your classroom. So highly recommend that book. This one I'll just reference to. I Am a Teacher and I Love It, written by Dina Swanson. I don't know if anybody's familiar with her, but again, just an inspirational book with great ideas in for your classroom. So, just a couple of plugs for those. So, why do we need procedures? Try to follow down across here. Why do we need procedures? First of all, they're a biblical concept. God established a lot of things in the Old Testament that was just the pattern, the way of doing things. And no, we don't follow all of those in our New Testament worship. But I think it just helps us see that God is a God of order. And even in our New Testament worship, we have a certain day when we go to church, right? We worship on the first day of the week. And so I think we can see that order, procedures, it's a biblical concept. Secondly, procedures help with time management and organization. You don't have to stand around trying to figure out how you're going to do something, because you already know. You've already decided this is the way I'm going to do it. Thirdly, procedures help to teach the importance of following directions. And that is something that school students need to learn how to do, to follow directions. Do you have to follow directions in your life at your age? Yeah, you do. You got to drive the speed limit. I mean, I guess you don't have to, but hopefully you do. There's consequences. So, I mean, life, no matter what your age is, there's directions you need to follow. And procedures in your classroom help to establish that in children's lives. Number four, procedures help to teach disciplines that help throughout life. We aren't naturally self-disciplined, at least not most of us, and procedures and self-discipline go hand in hand. Number five, they help reduce confusion. Procedures help to clear your brain and gives you time to focus on other things, because now instead of you worrying about, okay, how am I going to do this? When am I going to do this? You've already decided it and you just know that's how I'm going to do that. And so you can take your brain and apply that brain power to something else. It can bring mental peace, just kind of clarity to your brain. And again, this varies, helps to eliminate frustrations. Quick thing for you of something to illustrate what I mean. A number of years ago in my classroom, we have like these stations around the room. I had that at the time. And when it was time for recess, it would just, you know, hey, it's recess time. And the students would shove back their chairs and get up and just walk out of the classroom and we'd go for recess. And it got to where, and I'm not an OCD person, just ask my wife. I'm not necessarily a super organized person. But this started driving me crazy because these students would just get up and mill around and make their way out of the classroom. And the chairs were just left stuck out from the desk. And it was just, I was like, okay, done with this. And I said, okay, changing this. I'm going to say, get ready for recess. That means you push your chair back, you stand up, and you push your chair in. And then when everybody's ready, I'll say you're dismissed. And whoever's closest to the door that we're going out is going to go out of the room. And I don't know if you remember the old cell phone game on the old snake where you had the little line that you would chase the thing. I don't know if anybody knows that. But that's what we do. And it brought such mental peace to my brain because now it wasn't this chaotic scene. It was simply get ready for recess. And we don't practice it a lot, but I make it clear that's what I expect. And I've done that for several years now. And I like it because the room is clean when they leave. The chairs are all in under the desk. And we go out in an orderly fashion. And there's not just this milling around. So that's what I mean by mental peace. And don't be afraid to do that thing. Whatever it is like that you just say, hey, you know what? We're going to do it this way. Not because you're trying to make their life difficult, but just because it brings clarity, it brings peace, and you have mental capacity then to deal with other things. Number six, procedures help you to be efficient. It goes along with some of what we've already said. Number seven, they provide structure, which brings stability and security. And number eight, they help to create a safe learning environment. I'll try to pause here and there throughout and just see if you have any questions or any input. Any questions so far? You want a word again? Because like I said, I am going to go rapid fire. Yes, sir.
What did you say number seven was?
They provide structure, which brings stability and security. And as you'll learn, children very much need stability and structure and safety to learn. If a child is having a hard time expressing themselves, sometimes it might be because they don't feel safe. And so we obviously want to create a place where they feel safe and they can express themselves, their questions, and they can learn. Where do we get these procedures? First of all, pray for wisdom. You have the verse in James 1 that says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, something like that. And so we come to God, and without doubting, we simply ask God for wisdom. And it says he will do that. Secondly, we learn from others. You listen, you observe, you read, you come to Teacher Week, you see experienced teachers talking, and you just kind of sidle up and you listen. And you see what they're talking about and what they're doing. And then you don't try to be them, but you take what they've learned and you apply it. You heard some other resources earlier today, a lot of you, the Doc for Learning, there's places like that, where you can learn from others. And then thirdly, you can get these procedures from experience. And you say, well, I don't have any experience. Well, how many of you were a school student at one point in your life? That's what I figured. And so, do you have any memories of things that happened at school that you know won't work very well? Yeah, I see some heads going. You probably can think back to something that maybe you had a teacher that did that didn't work out well. Maybe it never got changed, but you're like, I don't want that. How many of you have some memories of some good things teachers did that helped school go well? Again, I see some hands. That's good. I hope you have those things. Pull from them. I had the same teacher from grade 7 through 10. And when I started teaching, I think probably more than I realized, I tended to do what he did when I was in school, because that was my experience. And he was, thankfully, an excellent teacher. So, where all do we need procedures? Well, maybe we should say, where don't you need procedures? Because we have a lot of busyness in our lives as teachers. And it starts, first of all, with our personal lives. So, where do we need procedures? We need them in our personal lives. I'm starting here because, as the teacher, you and your habits and who you are affects your classroom. And how are you going to lead others in a productive life if you can't lead yourself? You have to start by leading yourself. As we heard from Aaron earlier, in those questions you ask yourself of who you are and who your friends are and a lot of those things. So, a few procedures in your own life here. First of all, obviously, study the Word and pray. Study the Bible. Pray on your way to school. Maybe pray before you go to school. Pray at school. Find a spot. I would highly recommend you find a spot that kind of becomes your go-to place to pray before you start your day of school. And whether that is on the drive to school, whether that's after you get to school, if it's, you know, before you leave your bedroom at home, kneeling at your desk at school. But I would say that I have found that to be very, very important for my day, that I connect with God in some way like that. For me, it's normally on the front porch of our school. If you drive by my school at anywhere between about 8:10 to 8:20, you might see this random person out there pacing the porch, walking up and down the sidewalk, because I just don't stand still, and I'm thinking and praying, and that's my time. And then I'm on the front porch when students arrive. Getting to school, I stand by the front door, and I hold the door open, and I welcome every student from first grade up through into school for that day. That's a procedure I have. So, study and pray. Study the Bible and pray. Number two, personal procedures, habits, get good sleep. The old saying, early to bed, early to rise. I don't know that it makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, but it is a good practice. Early to bed, early to rise is good for you. They say that sleep before midnight is worth more than your sleep afterwards. Any of you testify to that? You know? Okay. Proven fact by you. All right. So take it to heart and remember it. We vary in the way we handle life, but to me, I would recommend you don't come skimming into school at about 8:15. Get there early enough, whatever early enough is for you, to be prepared. And that starts with getting out of bed in time. Number three, a good procedure is to spend time with your friends. Larry talked about that earlier. Don't let go of your friends. There's balance in that, but you still need time with your friends. Number four, interact with students outside of school. Our school has the practice of a meal schedule for us as teachers. Since I'm married, obviously we don't go away as much, but every other week we're supposed to go to one of the church family's homes for supper. And I enjoy that touch with my co-teacher. She goes somewhere every week if she wants to. So that's something good too. If your school doesn't do it, find other ways at least to interact with your students outside of school. Number five, attend church and school functions. Church and social functions, I meant to say. Attend church and social functions. Obviously go to church. I mean, it kind of goes without saying it. But don't overdo your social functions. You can be so busy with your friends. You know, they hired you to teach school, not to just hang out with your friends. And so you got to find that balance. But again, you know, go play some volleyball now and then, because it's good to just go get some good exercise and clear your brain and enjoy some life. Number six, exercise. Play with your students at school. Get exercise in otherwise as well. Exercise is good for you. And number seven, read. Read good books. Read some books just for fun. I think that's just okay. We read heavy books on how to teach and how to help disabled learners and things like that. You might eventually do some of that. But read some books just for fun, just purely for the joy of reading. Again, this varies quite a bit among us, but don't depend on your social media, YouTube, things like that to fill you as a person. Something about a book, just a good old-fashioned book with pages in, somehow just seems to have a little bit more reality and just fill you a little bit better. Engage your brain. is part of that. Don't just try to be, you know, fed. Engage your brain. And yeah, take care of yourself. Remember this, an empty vessel has nothing to pour out. So if you never infill, put anything into you, you have nothing to give. And so make sure that you're filling yourself so that you have something to give. All right, going questions. All right, going into some school things here, more particularly in preparing for your school year. Make sure you have all the books for the school year, at least if that's your job. Make sure you have all the books. Maybe that's already been done for you, but double check on that. Number two, scan the books. Get a feel for what you will be teaching, especially if it's something new. Now, maybe you get to teach the curriculum you had growing up. That's wonderful because you've got a little feel for what's coming. But scan the books. Number three, ask questions of former teachers. I like the idea that we heard earlier of a experienced teacher walking alongside a new teacher. Now, maybe you won't have that privilege, but if you can, reach out to the former teacher. Talk to your school board, the co-teachers, the principal, all those important people that can help you to understand what's expected of you. And, you know, maybe try to figure out what the culture in the school is like. So ask questions. Number four, plan the first several weeks of school. Get a planner. Write out what lessons you will be doing. So plan the first several weeks. Look ahead to know when you should be finishing curriculum. That's looking towards the end of the school year. So don't all of a sudden, oh, school's about to end and we're not done. So try to plan ahead that. But especially plan the beginning part of your school year. And why do I say that? Well, it comes back to what I said earlier. Then it gives you time to focus on other things. You're not spending your first few days trying to figure out, oh, am I to be doing math? Or what am I to be doing now? You lay that out. No, we're going to do this and this and this. And tomorrow, this and this and this. And then you have more mental time to deal with the other learning curves that you're going to have to deal with. Number five. I already mentioned this on the previous point, I guess. Know when curriculum should be completed. Know when your curriculum should be completed. Find out from your school board, are you expected to finish the curriculum or you just work till you reach the end of school and wherever you get, because some schools I think are that way more. They don't necessarily finish the book. If they don't get done, they don't get done. That, to me, that bugs me. I think if you're going to do a curriculum, finish it. Figure out how to get it done. Number six, overplan the first day. The more you wing it, the greater the chaos will be. Know that from experience. Plan plenty of activities unless you're diving right into the lessons. At our school, we have a half day, our first day, and typically we don't do much work. The students come, they bring all their gear, and we, you know, assign their desks, and they give them all the books, and, you know, we just kind of settle in and get to know each other again. And but one of the worst things is to get all of that done, and you look at the clock, and it's like, oh, it's only 11 o'clock. I got another hour to go, and I don't have anything left to do with these students. Yeah, you can always go out and play recess, but, you know, at least for me in Texas and mid to late August, it might still be 100 degrees outside, and you don't really feel like playing for a whole hour outside. So that's why I'm saying overplan the first day. It'd be better to have some activities that you just didn't get done than to sit around going, what do I do now? And you're just, because that puts a lot of pressure on you. What are you going to do? Because you're a new teacher. You don't have a lot of things to pull from, do you? And so overplan. Number seven, learn a little bit about your students beforehand, if you can. Learn a little bit about your students beforehand or before the year starts. Make sure you know how to spell their names and all of those things. And if you can learn any other bits of information, again, that depends. If you're teaching in your home community, you'll have a lot better handle on that. Next section, questions there. Have you got an idea you want to share? Something that worked or didn't work in your growing up years? All right, devotional period. Really quick, do you have any memories from school of the devotions that you really, really enjoyed? No? Okay, that's fine. Do your schools have a practice of brothers from the church coming in to have devotions? Good. Did you enjoy those? Most of us probably did. It depends. There's always the fathers that are just really good on those object lessons, and then there's other ones who just read a Bible story, right? And that's fine. We need variety. But all right, so devotional period. For me, I found it very helpful to have a schedule. And what I mean by that is I know what I'm doing on different mornings most of the time. So I've come to where Monday morning, I almost always read a story. Students come in Monday morning. They tend to be a little draggy from the weekend. And I try to read a story, what I would kind of term a hero of faith story, or some kind of story that has a really strong moral. It really teaches a lesson, but it might be a storybook. I read some from the book The Silent Whistle this past year, which are stories of Bible smuggling. So those type of stories, something that's very inspirational, teaches a lesson. I do that on Monday. Tuesday morning, we have our assembly devotions when a brother from church comes in. So Wednesday and Thursday mornings, I have to come up with devotions. And then Friday, we sing as a whole school. So with that kind of plan, I kind of know what I've got to have ready for which morning of the week. So that can help you focus your study and prep time. So number one, have a schedule. Number two, have a theme. Now, this isn't a have to, but if you have a theme, and what I mean by this is maybe you know that on those two or three mornings when you have to come up with the devotions, what are you going to focus on? Maybe on Wednesday morning, I will focus on character traits. And so that gives me already, I know what I'm going to go study for. I'm not just going to sit there and go, oh, what am I going to have for devotions tomorrow morning? And I'm trying to think just what Bible passage. Okay, I'm going to focus on character traits this year. Maybe fruit of the Spirit. And so you see how you've already decided beforehand and you kind of know which direction you're going to go. Maybe it's ABC Bible verses, just a Bible verse for every letter of the alphabet. Maybe it's character studies on Bible characters. There's a lot of options on that. That's where, look up some of these other places, the doc and other resources like that for different things like that. But it can help focus. Number three, in devotional period, sing, read the Bible, and pray. And maybe you don't do every one every morning, but I think it's good if you do a little bit or of those most mornings. Sing together, read the Bible, and pray. And I would say make sure you pray every morning with your class. Number four, involve the students. Involve the students. They can pick songs sometimes. We read around the classroom when we read a Bible passage a lot of times. You could take prayer requests. Those would be some things. So involve the students in the devotional period. And number five, keep the devotional short and practical to the age group. Short and practical. Don't try to fix class problems and personal problems and picks with students in devotions time. Keep it inspirational. You can, focus on character habits, but don't try to fix particular problems then. Don't try to convert them. You're not the evangelist. We're not child evangelists at all. You sow the seed. You present truth. And, depending on the age, if you have the opportunity to lead a student to Christ, that would be wonderful. But that's not your primary job, and so be careful that you're not just an evangelist. Preparing for class. Sorry, the handout is a little bit odd there. Somehow between the computer and the printer, it messed up. But anyway, preparing for class. Top of the second side there, I believe. Know which lesson. Know which lesson you're on. Nothing worse. Well, I shouldn't say nothing worse, but getting to class and realize you studied the wrong lesson and that you're actually on lesson six and not lesson five. That's why you make a plan ahead of time so that you know what lesson is coming. Number two, be familiar with the lesson. Think through how you're going to teach it, especially as a new teacher. That's going to be important. Be familiar with the lesson. Number three, look ahead. This goes more for classes like science and things like that, but look ahead especially to see if there's any special things coming, any special, science experiments or anything like that that you're going to need some supplies for. Look ahead. Remember, art class is coming. I'm bad about that. I know when I do art class, but somehow all of a sudden it's Thursday night and I got to plan art class. Art class is coming. Look ahead. You can ask the students to bring things for science experiments. Say, hey, you want to bring, whatever it is. We need some baking soda and some vinegar. We're going to pour them together and see what happens. So, hey, do you want to bring the vinegar? Can you bring the baking soda? Involve the students that way. Side note, when you do that, then you've got somebody else to blame if it doesn't show up. But it is good at student involvement, but then it does put it back in their laps. If they want to do the experiment, they got to remember. Number four, try to find practical explanations. And that can go for a lot of classes, especially math. If you're teaching about sales tax, don't just say, well, I'm buying something for $9.99. Say, hey, what do you want to buy today? What do you want to go to Walmart and buy? Anybody? Give me something you might go to Walmart and buy. A pair of shoes? I don't know where you buy shoes. A basketball? A ripstick? I don't know what, you know. But come up with something. Be specific. Make it practical. I went to Walmart yesterday and I bought, you know, new football for school. And then teach a sales tax. In language, use sentences that involve things that interest the students. Maybe you know that there's one that loves John Deere tractors, or they really like this. So make your sentences around that. Use students' real names, kindly, of course. But, you know, involve them in ways like that that they will catch on that you're using something that you know about in their life. You don't have to make any other comments, but you'll see the looks on their face. They know that you know what's behind that sentence. So, practical applications. Number five, if you have time, go outside the textbook. And again, that depends on which subject it is, but bring in facts and pictures that aren't listed in the textbook. Talk from, you know, other things, something that you saw, and, you know, you can bring it in. We can't do that with every class and every day, obviously, because we've got to do our normal things, just like right now. I'm going to have to hurry up. Number six, give examples from your own experience. Heard plenty about that earlier. Number seven, bring in the expert. What I'm thinking of here is what we talked about earlier this morning with Larry. Bring in a brother from church or somebody to give a talk. Example about that. Maybe there's somebody that's a builder and they can come in and talk about a blueprint and scale drawings on a blueprint. Maybe you have a brother in church who does concrete work and he can come in and talk about figuring the volume of a concrete pad and how he does, you know, things like that. So, let's see. Somebody in here, I think, talked about drawing blood, right? So, you know, if you've got somebody in your community like that, that maybe is in a field like that, that you don't really know anything about, you can invite them to come into your classroom and talk to your students about those things. Questions? Comments? All right, let's keep going. Conducting classes. Require promptness. When it's class time, you don't have to stand there for 30 seconds, a minute, waiting for them. They can put their books down. They can get ready for class. Require promptness. Number two, tell them what to expect in class time. Tell them what you expect. In my classroom, I came across this thing a while ago, and that's the second blank there. Give me five. And I use that in my classroom, and I always have it posted up on the corner of my whiteboard. But the five is this. Eyes are watching. Ears are listening, lips are zipped, hands are still, feet are quiet. And you can come up, you could adjust that however you want. Those are the ones that I used the other year. But then when you're having class, I usually have my students at a class table. And if they're, you know, getting a little whatever, I can be like, hey, give me five. And all you got to do is point to that and you're back on track, hopefully. And they know that they need to be paying attention. So you can come up with things like that that you can just kind of seamlessly work right into your class as you're speaking, and hopefully it pulls them back to where you want them. Number three, have a policy of how they answer questions in class. Have a policy of how they answer questions in class. Do they need to raise their hands and you call on them? Is it a free-for-all? I've seen both, and it's very frustrating to me as a teacher when you've got students here and they all just think they can talk whenever they want to. That drives me bonkers. I think raising hands is must. Now, I do then have times with review and things like that. Okay, shout the answer. And you just rapid fire and you let them express themselves. So have a policy of how you want to do it. Number four, review. Talked about that yesterday. I gave you some ideas on that. Be creative with that. There's ways to engage in review. Stand up, sit down, take steps around the room when they get it correct. Remember talking about that yesterday? Number five, teach the lesson, but don't bore them with what they already know. If they all have already done the lesson, and with a few questions or looking at their books, you know they've got the lesson down, they understood it, it's correct. Don't spend 10 minutes reteaching the lesson that they already know. You've just wasted your time and filled the room with hot air, and those students were bored to death. So teach the lesson, but don't bore them with what they already know. Number six, use the board. I find it very satisfying when I look up and my whiteboard is full of stuff, math problems and language sentences and things like that. Use the board. Most students love it. And you let the students come work at the board sometimes. Here's a good practice, especially like in math. I show, we do, they do. So you do a math problem on the board. How are we going to add this problem up? And so you show them. You put the problem up there, and you show them, this is how we do it. And then you put another problem up, and you say, okay, class, how do we do it? What's the first step? What's the second step? And they talk you through it, and you figure it out. Of course, that doesn't take much explanation. And then you say, all right, it's your turn. And they come to the board, and they do it. And that kind of involvement is great. Just ways to use the board to your advantage. Number seven, ask lots of questions. It stimulates their thinking and helps you know what they're getting and if they're getting it at all, or if you need to change tactics and go a different way. Ask lots of questions. And number eight, practice oral reading. Reading is an important skill for church and family life. Most of your students will someday either stand up in front of church or in a Sunday school class or somewhere like that. Practice oral reading, and reading is fun, I think. I love reading out loud. So, questions there? Study time. Study time. What do I mean by this? Well, study time, I'm thinking of time in your classroom when you're not teaching a class and the students are to be working. Number one, during that time, require quietness. Be real about it. Let them be children. I had one year where I was really hard at no communication in the classroom. And I came to discover that I had one girl that she was very conscientious, and she was scared to even look up because, am I communicating? Because I had some students one year that were really good at eye contact and, you know, the rolling eyeball thing with the friends, and I hate that. And so I was really hard on it, but I think I swung way too far that way, and that girl didn't know how to deal with it. So you have to be real. Have to let them be children. Good friends, one glance of their eyes and they know exactly what the other one's thinking, right? And so you got to be careful. You got to be real. You want them to be relaxed, but do require quietness. Number two, have signals for specific requests. This is one of those procedures that can just help you. You're teaching fifth grade math and little fourth grader over here needs to go use the restroom. And it's a legitimate need. Do you have to stop your class so that he can go? No, have some kind of signal. Three fingers, or you probably remember, did you have something like that growing up in school where you had a finger system? Okay, some of you did. It helps you so much. For me, I like that because I don't honestly remember always which one is which. Like I have one that's for a drink and one that's for the restroom, and I don't always remember which one is which. But I know that it's a reasonable request, and so I'll nod at them, and away they go, and I can keep going with my class. Now, I don't know if they ever know that I forget sometimes which is which, but it's just one of those things that clears your brain to keep going with your class, and their need is taken care of. And be respectful of their needs. You know, you've got those ones that want to run to the restroom just because they want a diversion. You know, they just want to walk up and down the hall. But do be careful, because if it's a legitimate need, they're not going to get any work done until they can run to the restroom. So be respectful of their needs. Number three, have a system for completing their work. That depends on the age of the students you're working with. Are they allowed to work before you come to class? You know, when do you expect them to have it done? Do they finish it in this certain period of time? Know when you want them to have it done. I require my students, I teach from about fourth, fifth grade up. I require my students to use a goal chart or a planner. We do mostly CLE, so CLE has pre-printed goal charts where they can fill in their assignments. And I do it because I want them to learn to how to manage their own life. And so I think fourth, fifth grade, they can easily be learning that. Here's your assignments for the day. I don't have to tell you, now do math, now do language, write it down at the beginning of the day. When you're done with it, cross it off. You got the satisfaction of checking it off. You know what you have left. You get to the end of the day, you can easily see what you didn't get done, and I don't have to micromanage. So have a system for completing their work. Number four, one person on the floor at a time. That depends on the size of the classroom, depends on the dynamic of the classroom itself. But too much coming and going is a distraction to you and to the other students. Again, we're a mostly CLE school where I teach, and so my students check their own work, and so there is coming and going as they go to their checking stations and back. But of course, it's one person at the checking stand at a time. You can't go check two people at a time at the same class. So it, you know, those things help to keep the flow from getting overdone. Number five, don't spoon feed your students. Show them how to find the answer. Don't give them answers. Questions, comments. Take a deep breath. You good? Is this helpful? Mostly? Okay, good. All right. Disciplining. Oh, this is the one you've been waiting for, right? How do I discipline them? Get a big long glue stick and swing. No, I'm kidding. All right, disciplining. Number one, ask for wisdom. Pray about it. Ask for wisdom and pray about it. And in a sense, we could stop there, but we do have to be practical. Number two, be consistent. And that's a tough one, at least for some of us. It is hard to be consistent. But just try. What you said today, do tomorrow, and keep up with it the next day. Number three, be calm. Try not to become emotional about it. When they act up and you have to address it, it can be intimidating. Even though I've taught a number of years, I still find that if I have to really address a student, it's really hard for me to stay calm. Because either I get kind of nervous, like, oh, I got to address this person, or I'm a little bit mad at them because, you know, you just messed up, right? Try to just be calm, be unemotional. We all make mistakes, so just calmly, hey, you know what? I need you not to do that. And that's where if we can have some procedures, it really helps to keep the emotions at rest because we're not, oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? You already know. But try to stay calm. Number four, think things through. Don't make spur-of-the-moment rules. I have shot myself in the foot more than once. Hey, can we do this, Mr. Stover? Yeah, I reckon. And then a day or two later, say, and then you got to backpedal and try to get it back. And so now I make it my practice, you know, hey, can we do this? Or what about this? Let me think on it for a minute. I'll give you an answer tomorrow. Or something like that. And there's nothing wrong. Most times, whatever it is that the students want to do, it'll be fine till tomorrow. I told you the story at the beginning about the students sitting on the shed roof. I didn't stop and think on that one, right? Don't let students do things like that. Don't give them a challenge because they'll probably go for it. So think things through. Don't make spur-of-the-moment rules. Number five, act decisively and then move on. Maybe you're teaching a class and little Susie there is just not paying attention. You need her to pay attention, so act decisively. Stop talking and just stare out the window. And 10 seconds feels really long when all of a sudden the teacher shuts up, right? I don't think I was quiet for even 10 minutes. You know how uncomfortable that gets really quick? So silence. All of a sudden, oh, what? And there. So act decisively and then move on. Sometimes you don't even have to say anything. You just stop and you might look at the person and then you go right back to teaching. Oh, they know. And everybody else knows who you looked at too. But you didn't have to do much, but you acted decisively and then you move on. Number six, do not tolerate bullying. Unfortunately, I think this is probably more of a problem than what we want to admit. Bullying can be a lot of things. You ever have? Well, no, most of you haven't taught. You know, you might say, okay, what are we going to play for recess? And the little boy sitting there, he kind of looks around at his best friend over here. That can almost be bullying. Because why is he worried about what John is going to say if he picks this game, right? We need to be really careful with that because he should be able to pick and play whatever he wants without the other students getting on to him for that. So don't be intimidated or bullied yourself. Maybe you can think about people in your own life that you find it really hard to just stand up and be yourself. They just You're intimidated. And that can even happen. You think, no way, younger student? But it can, because you don't want them to throw the fit or whatever is going to happen. So don't tolerate bullying. Number 7, keep rules few and simple. And the reason for that is because a rule needs to be enforced. See, a procedure is just something you say, hey, you know what? This is the way we're going to do it. Like I could tell you right now, when I dismiss you, I want row 1 to go first, row 2, row 3, row 4. And I could tell you that. It's just the way I said, hey, let's do it today, right? Because I'm the teacher and I get to tell you that, right? I could. I'm not going to. If I say we have a rule that you must not leave your row until the row behind you, you know, all this. Well, now suddenly I should back that up, right? Because if you violate that, now I said this is a rule. It's like a speed limit. It's not like, hey, drive 55 if you want to. We suggest you do. No, you drive 55 or there's consequences, right? So be really careful with your rules and your procedures because a rule needs to be enforced. And so don't make too many of them or you will spend your entire day just trying to enforce your rules. That's why we have procedures, because it makes things flow. It's not right or wrong. And they're probably going to be like, hey, Mr. So-and-so last year, he didn't make us do that. Do I look like Mr. So-and-so? No, I don't. So, I mean, be kind about it, but you can be that blunt. You're not, I'm not Mr. Overhaul. And so I'm going to teach differently than he does. Is that okay? Sure it is. He can have his classroom. Derek can do it how he wants. So don't be intimidated by that. Keep your rules few and simple. Number 8. Communicate with parents promptly. Honor the parents. You work for them. So communicate with the parents promptly. And don't only communicate the bad things. Communicate good things. Hey, your child was really kind yesterday. Think about it like this. Your relationship with your student's parents is sort of like a bank account. And so put good in so that when you need to make a withdrawal, there's something there. That's not original with me, but I think it's an excellent example. So feed positive. Feed positive. It tends to be that we don't talk to the parents much except when it's something negative and, oh no, here comes the teacher, what now? No, make it positive so that if you do have something that does need addressed, you can more easily do that. Number 9, observe if you aren't sure about something. And what I have in mind here is that if a student lied or cheated once, but you're not quite sure, what does a liar usually do?
Do it again.
They do it again. If they cheat once, they will almost always cheat again because liars and cheaters have to cover their trail, right? How do they cover their trail? They do it again. And that was advice that was given to me, I don't remember, a long time ago, and that has stuck with me. And again, we can be careless. Well, okay, I'm not going to do anything. We'll see if they do it again. But if you're really not sure, give it a little bit of time because you don't want to falsely accuse a student of lying or cheating if they didn't. So observe if you're not sure about something. Number 10, get help. There's people that are ready to help you. Talk to the board, other trusted people. Do not bottle your frustrations until you explode. Some of us, again, our personalities tend to be more that way. We just kind of stuff it down, keep going until we finally blow. That's not a good habit. Number 11, use a demerit system. This can be a lot of different ways. I use an economy system in my classroom. Simple money system, fake money, not real money. And there's a lot of levels of that you can use. The main thing that I have use it for anymore, I used to have a more glorified system with younger students, it doesn't work as well. So again, with doing CLE, they do their work, they go correct it. In CLE, if you're familiar with it, there's a lot of parts. Circle this, underline this. If they don't follow directions, they owe me $100. If they miss a part, they owe me $100. And so when I'm flipping through books after school, oh, here's $100. Huh, sure enough, they messed up on that part. It makes them be accountable. And I love it because I try to keep them on their toes. And sometimes I find things and then I write, fine. And they have to pay me the $100 if I catch it. But a lot of them, after a year or two in my classroom, they catch it and the money just, I'll come in and, oh, $100 on my desk. Well, I'm not even sure who it was. Somebody messed up and they pay their money and keep going. And I love that. So if you want to know more, I'll be glad to tell you more. You can really build that whole thing out. All right, let's see if we can quickly finish up. Recess time. I'm going to move quickly over some of these. Number 1, be clear with your expectations. are you going to go play a game or just let them have free time? Number two, have dismissal practices. I talked about that. How are you going to go out for the recess? Number three, pick the game before you leave the classroom. That helps you not just stand around on the playground wondering what you're going to be playing. Everybody knows whether you're headed to the volleyball court, the softball field, where you're going. Pick the game before you leave the classroom. Number four, have the person who picked the game get the needed equipment. And little things like this. Everybody shows up out to play volleyball and nobody grabbed the volleyball. All right, so the person that picked the game, you just say, hey, have it known from the beginning of the year, they're the one that needs to go get the ball and bring it out. Number five, require participation. Recess time is not optional, but do be careful to honor mom. If mom sends a student to school and says they have a cold, I'm not supposed to play, I don't question that much. I try to honor the mom, and if mom says they shouldn't be playing, then unless it goes too long, then you might want to see if it's legitimate. But do require participation. Number six, play with your students. I think that's very important, and as we've heard already, you can learn a lot of life lessons for yourself and your students by playing with them. Number seven, be clear when recess is over. Be clear when recess is over. And number eight, be prompt and quiet in returning to the classroom. Prompt and quiet in returning to the classroom. Maybe your school has a policy of being quiet in the hallways and bathroom rules and a lot of things like that. Teacher checking, checking papers. Number one, be organized. Be organized. Maybe you have stackers where the students put their work. Maybe they have notebooks, but have somewhere where the work is to be put when they're done. Be organized. Number two, have a specific time you check. Are you going to check right after school, or are you going to study for the next day and then check later? And you might not do it the same every time, but I can tell you if you don't have a specific time, it probably will get pushed out later, because unless you love to check papers more than a lot of teachers that have done it. Number three, do you need to check it or scan over it? You can overload yourself by thinking you have to look at every question. And there again, it depends whether you're just looking over it or whether you're actually checking it. That depends a lot on your curriculum. Number four, cut out distractions. Leave your phone lie, don't pick it up. Don't go have too long a discussion with your co-teacher. Co-teachers are important. Make sure you keep relationships there. But, you know, don't let that keep you from getting your work done. Maybe you need the Pomodoro method, which is where you work for 25 minutes on one thing and take a 5-minute break. So maybe you sit down and you check diligently for 25 minutes. And by then your brain is just, it's full. Well, get up and take a 5-minute break. Maybe you need to go restock some supplies in the bathroom or do something else. And something like that can help keep you from getting too, you know, your brain too overloaded. Checking in class. Will some of you be checking in class? Okay, I'll go over this real quick then for you. Have a system for who checks which book, so that best friends aren't always trying to check each other's. Have, you know, pass around the circle or however you have it, but have a system that it just gets exchanged. Number two, have a certain color pen for checking. Normally it's red, but you could do whatever, but it's nice if you have a standard color, I think. Number three, require close attention. Make them pay attention so you don't have to read stuff three and four times. Require close attention. Number four, read answers without stopping. Go down over, read everything, make them pay attention. And then number five, take questions at the end. If you stop every time somebody raises your hand, you won't get to the bottom of the page for who knows how long. So make them pay attention. Go down the page and take their questions at the end. And number six, will you give the grades right there in class, or will you write them on yourself later? Will you give grades in class or write them on yourself? All right, students' free time. Got a section there, I'll buzz over that real quick for you. What do you do when your students are done with all their work? You're gonna have those that are faster and they get done, and then you're gonna have the ones that aren't done yet. So, let them read, number one, let them read. Number two, let them create something. Maybe they're coloring, drawing, construction paper, things like that. Try to get them to be creative. Number three, study Bible memory. Study Bible memory. Number four, write a report. Assign them to go look something up in the encyclopedia. Depends on the age, but you know. What are you interested in? Oh, I love horses. All right, look it up. Write me a paragraph about horses. Number five, Make them go double check their work. There's those students that they've got to beat everybody else and get done first. Make them go back and double check it. Number six, clean their desk. Some of them will definitely need it. Make them clean their desk. Number seven, maybe they'll play a game. Monopoly, chess, a game like that. I would recommend you kind of pick your games carefully. Something that can teach them some skill. Monopoly, they've got to handle money. Chess is a strategy game, right? So some games like that can be okay. Depending on the age of the student, number eight, they could help other teachers. We've started doing that some in our school, where the girls in the upper grades will go help the lower grade teacher out a little bit. All right, miscellaneous is miscellaneous. Network with other teachers. If something isn't working, change it. Don't keep beating your head against a brick wall wondering why nothing changes. You're not going to beat the brick wall down with your head. So if it's not working, change it. Number three, keep your school board in the know. And number four, get objective opinions from trusted individuals. Don't just go ask any random person. Make sure it's somebody who can give you a good objective opinion if you need some help. All right, fire hose is now done. Good luck. No. Remember this. This is just to give you some ideas, some helps. You don't have to do all of these things. You can pick one or two, but it's just to give you some practical ideas. I'm sure there's things on here that Derek never did in his classroom. There's things that Derek probably did that I've never done. And so you adopt and you learn from each other, but it's not that you have to do all of these things. And as your students change from year to year, so will your procedures. So the question is, who's running your classroom? The students or you? You need to run your classroom. You say how it's going to go. Make sure that the students can learn. Make sure that they enjoy coming to school. And make sure that they feel secure. God is a God of wisdom. He says, seek, ye shall find, knock, and it shall be opened. So lean on him and pray. Seek after him. God bless you all.